Om Agyana Tinirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shugarave Namaha Vinischityaivam Rishayo Vipannasya Mahipatehe Mamantur Urung Tarasa Tatrasid Bahuko Naraha. Yeah, move the book a bit closer. Translation. After making a decision, the saintly persons and sages churned the thighs of the dead body of King Vena with great force and according to a specific method. As a result of this churning, a dwarf-like person was born from King Vena's body. Purport, that a person was born by the churning of the thighs of King Vena proves that the spirit soul is individual and separate from the body. The great sages and saintly persons could beget another person from the body of the dead King Vena, but it was not possible for them to bring King Vena back to life. King Vena was gone and certainly he had taken another body. The saintly persons and sages were only concerned with the body of Vena because it was a result of the seminal succession in the family of Maharaj Dhruva. Consequently, the ingredients by which another body could be produced were there in the body of King Vena. By a certain process, when the thighs of the dead body were churned, another body came out. Although dead, the body of King Vena was preserved by drugs and mantras chanted by King Vena's mother. In this way, the ingredients for the production of another body were there. When the body of the person named Bahuka came out of the dead body of King Vena, it was really not very astonishing. It was simply a question of knowing how to do it. From the semen of one body, another body is produced, and the life symptoms are visible due to the soul's taking shelter of this body. One should not think that it was impossible for another body to come out of the dead body of Maharaj Vena. This was performed by the skillful action of the sages. Another decision is made by the rishis, the saintly persons and sages, on what to do next. Seems they hadn't planned this in advance. It was a desperate situation. We see that when Parikshit Maharaj committed an offense to the father of Sringi, whose name was? I'm forgetting. Shami. Yeah. So, the father, he rebuked his son. Why are you treating the... Oh, the son responded by cursing the king to die, and the father was very upset. Shamikarish, was it? He was very upset. How can you pronounce such a curse on the king? That in itself is a highly sinful thing to do. Because the king is the upholder of the Varnashram institution. It's like a father to the citizens. And in the absence of the king, then all problems become present in human society. So it's a great sin. Even in Europe, the few kings were killed here and there, and by citizens. If one king kills another in battle, that's considered fair enough, that he's not competent anyway to... If he dies, well, the next king comes in. One king can kill another. But if the citizens kill a king, that's considered very sinful. That was considered sinful even in Europe. There's even a word for it in English. Regicide means to, just like homicide means to kill a man, so regicide means to kill the king. Then it became more or less normal. They made a habit of it in various places. But it was considered very sinful because the king is the Naradhipa, the leader of the people. Naranang cha Naradhipam, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. He's the, among men, the king is the representative of Krishna. Interestingly, he says, in this context, because there are brahmanas who are also representatives, but Krishna especially refers to the king as his representative. Of course, the brahmanas, they're sometimes considered deva also, the gods among men. So here we find that the sages, who are saintly persons and not demons, they killed the king. It was a must have been a very difficult decision for them to take, because you're not supposed to kill kings. You're not supposed to kill anyone under, unless there's some need for it. Generally, it's one tries to avoid killing any living being, but sometimes it becomes necessary. But as much as possible, it should be avoided. So we see that the sages, they took the momentous decision. They decided this is the, under the circumstances, it's the right thing to do. If the king is so wicked, then he should be removed completely. He didn't respond to reasonable advice. He was incorrigible, and therefore he had to be killed. And the sages did that by their Brahma Teja, by their Brahminical power. So we see that it's not possible to always be nice. It's recommended, be nice. Do good, be good. What is that, the Sai Baba they say? Always, what is it? Love all, hate none. What is it? Do good ever, do harm never, all this kind of thing. Little slogans. So the idea that we should always be nice is actually a very dangerous idea. Because if you're nice to people who are not nice, then you end up in a lot of trouble. And that's a problem in the modern age, because, well, of course, this statement may be considered a politically charged statement, but there are considerable sections of a what is called in India a minority religion who are determined to be nice in their own way, which is not considered nice under any normal human conditions. They think they're benefiting society by killing people. But the damn stupid government thinks we should be nice to them. Of course, it's a complex issue, but they're not facing the fact. And not only in India, but in many countries of the world, they're not facing the fact that in this minority religion, of course it's not minority everywhere, but there are many members who are trained to be hateful towards others, even from childhood. Some of them are trained just to kill the kafirs. So it doesn't make any sense to show niceness to such people. So that was the decision that the sages took, and they killed King Vena because he was incorrigibly wicked. they made that decision. And it appears they were writing the score as they went along, as the saying goes. They weren't sure what to do. At the time that they did that, they were not thinking what to do next, because every action produces consequences. And they ended up in a situation in which they had no king. The result of having no king is that the thieves and rogues immediately became active. And although they had one rogue at the head of the state previously, at least he kept all the other rogues in check. So we see that it's practically that. Just like, for instance, in the erstwhile Soviet Union, the government was highly repressive, including to criminals, to everyone. And criminals had a really tough time, which means there weren't many criminals. People were afraid. But then as soon as the governmental system changed and they became more liberal and fair to everyone, then the rogues came out, and Russia's in the mafia in Russia is a high at the present time, or practically since the time when they removed the restrictions, the underworld elements are prominent in society. They immediately came out. So a good king is required, who knows who to repress, who to control, and who to exercise liberality toward. But we find that an oppressive king, he's oppressive to everyone. And then the liberal government, they're liberal to everyone, and neither is balanced. Liberality is required for those who don't misuse it, and punishment is required for those who do, or who would otherwise misuse the freedom which is accorded to cooperative citizens or respectable citizens. So the sages made a decision. They would have known that the bad elements would come out, but it seems they didn't have time to take everything in stock when they made the decision. Or we don't know exactly. We don't have all the background. In any story that's told, you don't get every little detail given. So they may have been hoping for something better, but practically the situation arose where they needed a king. And the body of King Vena had been preserved in oil and with mantras chanted by the mother of King Vena. There's not stated in the Bhagavatam itself, but in the purport, which means it's probably stated in another Purana elsewhere. So from that body, the saintly persons, they churned the thighs, and first of all nasty looking dwarf came out. These sages, they made the decision that we will produce from the body we will call forth a fitting successor of Dhruva Maharaj, someone who is worthy to rule. Dhruva, Anga, and Vena was due to being born from the womb of the daughter of death personified, then he became himself like death personified. So the sages, they made a decision, and as a result, as a consequence of this churning, this dwarf-like person was born from King Vena's body. That wasn't who they wanted to be the king. He was as if the representative of all the sinful desires of King Vena. So once that was removed, then a worthy successor of the dynasty of Dhruva Maharaj could be produced. We find in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna speaks of divine and demoniac qualities, abhijato si pandava, ma shucha sampadam daivam, abhijato si pandava. Don't worry, Arjuna, you are born with the divine qualities. I'll describe the demoniac qualities, but you don't worry. I'm not blaming you. I'm not talking about you. You are divine. You are born with such qualities. And the demoniac qualities are described as people are born with such qualities. Of course, qualities can also be imbibed by association. It may be that someone is basically not of very good qualities, but if they associate with people of good qualities, they can imbibe those good qualities, and vice versa. We see that people who have basically good qualities, by associating with low-class people, they also become devoid of good qualities. So there are different factors. It's an ongoing discussion within the fields of psychology, sociology. It's not so much ongoing. They've more or less decided that everyone is born equal, but by association and training, they turn out the way they do. Still it's accepted that otherwise why are they so busy or wanting to do cloning? So it's accepted to some extent though, that character depends on birth, and in the modern understanding that is according to one's genetic, inherited genetic patterns. And another school says no, it's according to the association one has. So, but we find in the Vedic understanding that both of these factors are important in shaping the character of people. It's not just that by good birth one becomes good. Even if one is born in the best of families, both husband and wife being of good background, good character, which wasn't the case in the case of Vena. His father was good, but his mother wasn't. So, even if one is born of good parents, still training is required. It's not just that they automatically become good, but one is born of good parents and they send the child at a young age to be trained by an ideal person, with the idea that they can also become an ideal person by such association and training. Traditionally, the gurus would accept children of a good background. Generally, that would be a Brahmana family. Brahmana or also Kshatriya, Vaishya, but for deep training in Shastra. That was especially for the Brahmanas. So we find in the case of that, Satyakama, he wasn't, well, we don't know what family background he's from, but apparently Shankaracharya says, well, he must have been a Brahmana, but it seems not. At least the character of his mother seems to have not been very good. It definitely wasn't very good, and that's the whole point. But he was accepted as a Brahmana, unusually. Generally, it's if you're born of a good family, then you must be fit material for shaping. Just like certain clay is good for making pots. Not any, you just can't pick up any earth anywhere. If you try to make sand into pots, then you're not going to be successful. It requires a certain kind of clay that can be shaped. And it would, if you try to shape sand into pots, then it's not going to work, however expert the potter may be. But pots cannot be made of sand. And among clays there may be some which is better than others, but it remains clays that may be suitable for making pots. Among the clays that are suitable for making pots, some may be more suitable than others. But an expert potter, he can make a good pot, even out of a less suitable clay, but not out of sand. No one makes pots out of sand. So in the same way, those who are born from a good family, one that's followed the Vedic principles that was discussed in the previous verse, the purificatory processes beginning with Garbhadhan Sanskar. Sanskar means purificatory process. Then it is expected that they will give birth to children who are fit to be shaped, fit to be trained. So the responsible parents would send their children to be trained by a person who himself had been trained previously, an ideal person. There would be the guru. Later in life, it's possible that one may accept another guru also. There may be one who teaches one a good character, general knowledge, but then for one's spiritual uplift, one goes to a guru, just like for deeper spiritual understanding. Just like we see, for instance, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, his guru, who was in his childhood, was Gangadas Pandit. But later he took spiritual initiation from Ishwarapuri. So general education was there, in knowledge of Shastra. And no doubt Gangadas Pandit, any guru will impart just by the, mainly by their own behavior, they will impart how to behave, various usages, behavioral usages. But for spiritual upliftment, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu surrendered at the lotus feet of Sri Ishwarapuri, who taught him what Gangadas didn't teach him. The essence of life. So, such gurus, it's more common to find a guru who will teach knowledge, the basic knowledge. I mean, there's a class in human society of the brahmanas who will, among the brahmana class, there are brahmanas who teach young boys. They give them their basic education. But there are others who are, they may be quite rare. Durlabha Sadguru Devi. It's very rare to find kind of guru who will give tadvijnanartham, the vijnana, the realized knowledge, by which one can become free from birth and death. And even beyond getting free from birth, what could be beyond that? Most transcendentalists cannot even perceive that there can be anything beyond getting free from birth and death. But even far beyond that is Krishna consciousness, pure devotional service. So such a guru is very rare, and if one can get one, then such a person can transform one. It's a transformational process. Vena, he was not capable of being transformed. It was not possible to transform him. The sages tried. They tried to give him good advice, but he didn't listen. He became offended by the sages. He became offended by everyone, pretty much, if there's life. Even for no reason, he would kill people, just for fun, so to speak. So he became offended at the suggestion of the sages that Vena, should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but he misquoted Shastra to say that, well, I'm the Supreme. You should worship me. So he was incorrigible. And Bahuk also was presumably incorrigible. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, among all the avatars, he is the best. Although they're all the same Supreme Personality of Godhead. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is the best because he transforms the hopeless cases. Those who are fit for neglecting at best, or if necessary, killing also. If you're really want to be a demon to the full extent and you practice hard enough over enough lifetimes, of course, your lifetimes, they get interspersed with long sessions in a very nasty place and in the lower species of life. But if one is really an eligible demon, if you become really eligible enough, you can get killed by the Supreme Lord. And then that's it. You get liberation. It's not a recommended process to get liberation. It's risky, and it's more likely to end up in many, many births in the lower species of life and in hellish conditions. So that's one way to get liberation, but not recommended. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, especially in this Kali Yuga, because anyway it's difficult to be so bad as Hiranyakashipu, because people aren't powerful enough. I mean, even the demons, they try their best and they're pretty bad, but they can't get power to the extent that Ravana or Hiranyakashipu, they just people are weak. They think Hitler was bad, but he was just, you know, he was just a little pipsqueak compared to Hiranyakashipu. He just terrorized a part of this planet, but Hiranyakashipu was terrorizing the whole universe. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he doesn't kill anyone, but he kills their material desires. And so therefore he's the best of avatars, because he reforms even those who would normally be considered irreformable. One may approach a spiritual guru later in life, as I was saying, but for further transformation, the guru transforms one from janmana jayate shudra sanskara bhavet dvija, that from being merely a dvija, boy, the child is considered Shudra, on the level of a Shudra. But then when he has the Upanayana, then that's a Sanskara. He becomes twice born. But for that twice, of course, you see some children are born and then they just die for lack of nourishment or whatever. So if the Dvija, one who goes through the Upanayanam, he doesn't get the Vedic knowledge, he's not trained in Vedic knowledge, then it's like a child takes birth, they're not fed, then they just die. Then they're no longer a, they're a Nirja, no birth, or dead. Here the word is given for dead, Vipanasya, one who has the quality of Vipanna, dead. Vipanna, that's generally means, or maybe that's Vipanna. What's that? It means like depressed. We find in Chaitanya Charitamrita that's often used, that word. What does it mean? Do you know that word? You don't know the derivation. Okay. Anyway, here it definitely describes the decidedly dead king. He was quite dead. I mean, sometimes you're not sure, but they were sure. He was completely dead. So, the one may go through the Upanayanam Samskara and become a Dvija, but then if one is not trained in Vedic knowledge, then what's the point of, it's just like, what's the point of giving birth to children if you don't feed them and nourish them? So what's the point of giving anyone Upanayanam Samskara unless you train them in Vedic knowledge, which goes on today? Usually the brahmanas, they club the Upanayanam Samskara together with the marriage because it saves money. But it's all meaningless because they're supposed to have Upanayanam Samskara, go for training and then come back and get married. But it's just become a formula. It's just a ceremony. But they're not actually twice. Actually, they're getting married at the age of 98 or something, whatever age they get married these days. Usually, well, anyway, 28 at least, usually. And anyway, they're past the age for Upanayanam. That's stated in Shastra. They're by the age of 16 at the latest, if they don't have the Upanayanam, then they're just Shudras, finished. There's no question of reformation. So the Vedic knowledge has to be taught to them. Then, Veda Patit Pavit Vipra, then they become Vipra, a learned person. But still, they may become learned by that's transformation. Upanayanam Samskara, it's a Samskara, a transformation. But the transformation comes by the education. But then, further transformation has to take place if they're actually to become a Brahmana. Brahma janatiti brahmana. If they know Brahma, then they become a brahmana. Brahma vid brahma eva bhavati. By knowing what is Brahma, they become brahmana. Or they become Brahma. They become of the quality of Brahma. So the one may approach a guru. That's not forbidden for further spiritual, intense spiritual understanding. We see in the modern age that people come, often they come to Krishna consciousness after a life of kusanskar or bad impressions. So people are coming and more like Bahuka, full of sinful desires. But there's the desire to become transformed by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. That is possible. Dina hino joto chilo harinaame udharilo. This Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's process, that even those who are very fallen and sinful, they can be uplifted, which wasn't considered generally possible in previous ages, or possible by a very slow process. That those who are sinful, but not the most sinful, they get born in a Shudra family, and by serving the higher castes, then they become eligible in the next birth to take birth in a family where they're not so... if they're not too bad Shudras, if they don't steal too much or indulge in too many activities which would be considered grossly sinful for others, then they can get a higher birth, and then they can gradually go up and up and up and gradually take birth as a Brahmana and eventually attain perfection after many births. So the Varnashram system is a system of gradual purification. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's process it's virtually instant. Often devotees say, well, you know, I've been chanting for so many years, still I have so many bad things in my mind, and it doesn't seem like I'm making any progress. But they forget that. And normally, to go from the position that we started off in, I mean, we wouldn't even be allowed, we wouldn't be accepted as candidates at all for accepting a guru or being trained in spiritual life. They're totally unqualified, not only unqualified, disqualified. So, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy is thus that there can be transformation if one wants it. That's when one can advance as much as one desires to. If one doesn't submit himself for training and purification, then ipso facto, you can't be trained or purified. It's not just, many devotees approach me and ask for blessings. I get a bit fed up of it. You know, blessings, blessings, but there's this idea, just some kind, like in the Shakta Sampradaya, Shakti part, you just, and all of a sudden you get some electric shock, something like this, and then you become transformed, just like in modern Bengali folklore. There's the story of how one Gadadhar Chattopadhyay, otherwise known as, anyway, I won't say his name, certain Paramahamsa, touched his disciple, who felt a flow of current into him, and it was so powerful that he passed out. And then he woke up after some time to see his guru, so-called guru, crying, and he asked him, why are you crying? Because I gave everything I had to you. Nonsense. So people are asking for blessings, just blessings. You know, I'll watch TV and eat kami food, and you bless me and I'll become Krishna conscious. It doesn't work. We have to do our work. We have to make our own decision to be Krishna conscious. The blessings are there if we are serious to take to Krishna consciousness. But if we're not, then as much as we may make a show of asking for blessings, then we won't get them, because or even if we do get them, we have to take them. The blessings are there in the form of instruction. So transformation comes by accepting the process that is given by saintly persons and sages. And if we don't accept it, if we resist, no, I can't do this, won't do that, then it's not going to happen. So the sages, they, by some process that we are not aware of nowadays, they brought to life from the dead body of King Vena a dwarf who was the embodiment of many sinful desires. Srila Prabhupada writes here that it was not astonishing that a person came out of the dead body. Prabhupada writes, it was really not very astonishing. It was simply a question of knowing how to do it. It's an interesting comment because that's what the mundane scientists say. They presume that there is no God, and that what God-believing persons ascribe to God are or supernatural occurrences. The mundane scientists, they either deny that such occurrences take place, or they say that, well, it can be explained by mundane phenomena or measurable phenomena. We may not be aware of it now, but in future we'll become aware. And they say that, well, if something, what we see as astonishing, takes place, then it must be some material process, and it's just a matter of knowing how to do it. If you don't know, it may seem like a miracle. But if you do know, it's just normal. Just like turning on a TV and then watching whatever's on the TV to people who have no knowledge, if there are any such people left in the world, which I doubt, the people who have no knowledge of such a contraption, they may think that this is a miracle. But for most people in the world, it's absolutely everyday activity. So the mundane scientists say that, well, it's just a matter of knowing. Whatever we think is miraculous, it just means that we haven't yet understood the mechanism by which it is done. So here Prabhupada writes a similar thing. It's the sages, they were able, by churning the thighs of the dead body of Vena, they were able to produce another body. So Prabhupada said, well, it's not very astonishing. It's a material, mechanical process. We can't imagine it in the modern age, how that could be done, but it was able to be done. And Prabhupada, he doesn't question it. He doesn't say, well, you know, that's just ridiculous. It's just one of those silly things written in the books of Hindu mythology. He doesn't say that. He say, yeah, it took place, but so what? The people, modern scientists might say, well, you know, that's not possible. It's just a ridiculous story, how from a dead body, a living body was produced. The Prabhupada said, well, why not? They know how to do it. They did it. You don't know how to do it? You can't do it. The Prabhupada didn't question the possibility of that. And he writes, one should not think that it was impossible for another body to come out of the dead body of Maharaj Vena. Don't think like that, Prabhupada warns us. Don't think that this is just some made-up story. It's possible, just we don't know the science, that's all. So, Hare Krishna, any question, please?
Srila Prabhupada wants to re-establish Varnashrama. So that is like...
Srila Prabhupada wants to establish Varnashram. Yeah, I'm guessing what your question is. That is it going to be like the old system that we have families of brahmanas in which in those families they generally produce brahmana stock and the kshatriyas will produce kshatriya stock? I don't know. To re-establish such good family lines, it seems to be a very tall, a very, very great challenge to do so, considering that previously the lines were preserved so well, and definitely in outside of India they're completely mixed up. I mean, anyway, they're fallen, and then they got mixed up completely. So there's no saying by birth who anyone is. That's why that's one reason they think everyone's equal, because yeah, everyone's at the lowest possible standard, so everyone's equal. But up to the present, there's still the vestiges of the caste system are going on in India, and we do see that there's still some tendency within the castes, I would say. This is my personal observation, which I could probably be imprisoned for saying if I said it publicly. Probably, there's probably a law like that, that if I said that, well, generally we see that the Brahman, those born of the Brahmana caste, they're more intelligent, generally speaking, and piously inclined. And people from a very low caste background, they tend to be less intelligent and somewhat gross. And people from, that's very prominent, the Vaishya families. We still see people from Vaishya families. The very natural and tendency toward making money. That's still very prominent. Just like, for instance, in Gujarat, the Patels. Patel means a farmer and businessman, and still that's what they do. And they do it very well, actually. I mean, they're naturally inclined to... Of course, you get Patel doctors and university professors and deputy prime minister. What was Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel? What was his designation? Anyway, he was a politician of sorts. So... But in general, well, that's just an example. And here in the south, it's the Chettiyas down here. They're the business community, and so they're naturally inclined to that, and they naturally take it up. So maybe in India, that could be revived to some extent. In the West, it seems doubtful, but we'll have to see if. I mean, even to get Varnashram going at all in any ways, it seems to be a great challenge. Yeah, what's your thought about this?
My main question was that, like, in Kali Yuga, the Yuga Dharma is chanting the holy names of the Lord.
Yeah, the Yuga Dharma, the Yajna is Harinam.
But in the Vedas, majority of the part of Yajurveda is perform those homams.
How to perform Yajnas, yeah.
Those will be revived or just...
Would those be revived? Well, they're not completely dead, as we've seen in the last few days. But they won't have the same prominence as chanting of the holy names. Srila Prabhupada used to be a famous quote within ISKCON, that Srila Prabhupada made a certain statement, which I'm going to quote now. You don't hear it so much nowadays. And we don't have any official record. It's not in any of Prabhupada's books or recorded conversations, like several of Prabhupada's what are supposed to be important quotes, but apparently he said that the children of his disciples' children would light the sacrificial fire by mantra. It's a well-known quote. Then, in that regard, also, when I was in the pit for the Bhumi Puja 2 days ago, the Preeti Vardhana Prabhu, he asked me to, having put me through the ceremonies, which were also much abbreviated actually, even from, well, like for instance, we used, just by showing water, we did the offering, the dhoop and deep and all these pushpa and all the other things, and we... Maybe if there'd been more time, it wouldn't have been that difficult to offer an actual all these things. But then he asked me to, or directed me to pray to Ananta Shesh, to manifest himself and to support the temple. I can't remember exactly what he said. And so when I did that, then he asked, well, shall we ask everyone present to pray for Ananta Shesh, to Ananta Shesh also? I said, kirtan is going on, everything is accomplished, everything is complete by Harinam. So he asked me if he should, and my opinion, I wasn't ready, you know, to pull out all the shastras and have a look and see, but that was my immediate response, that well, Harinam is going on, everything is perfect by Harinam. So it's not that all the Vedic usages will be stopped by because Harinam is there. And it would appear that Srila Prabhupada wanted that there will be a class of brahmanas who are expert in performing various ceremonies. For instance, these sangskars, Srila Prabhupada definitely wanted them introduced. Who will do that? It requires a pure person to do so, to perform the sangskars. Their role is somewhat akin to that of this famous word, a ritvik. They're not the actual guru of the person, but they perform the ritualistic function for him. So it's somewhat akin to that. But ritvik, by the way, I'm using in the original sense of the term, which means someone who performs a sacrifice, or one of the priests in performing the sacrifice for others. So it's not the idea that you know you get any slob can come along and be a ritvik, or it required to that. I mean, if they say no one's qualified to be a guru according to Shastra, well, no one's qualified to be a ritvik either. Because the qualification to be a brahmana is it far surpasses a brahmana fit to perform sacrifices. It far surpasses what most of us are any level that most of us are on, apart from our chanting of Hare Krishna, which covers all other disqualifications and awards all qualifications. So one can be a brahmana, a yagyik, a ritvik, a guru by one's nama nishta, one's faith and attachment to the holy name of Krishna. So, yeah, there should be expert brahmanas, but their expertise and their ability, everything will, as in any age, it will depend on the mercy of Krishna, but the considerable lack of qualification compared to previous ages is made up by the one great qualification of faith in the holy names of Krishna. Yeah, much more could be said about that. That's a general principle, but it could be elaborated more. Yes, please.
Given almost no one has the purity of Srila Prabhupada.
Almost no one has the purity of Srila Prabhupada. I would leave the word almost out of that. It's the tremendous stature or spiritual stature of Srila Prabhupada. Yeah. No one, we don't see anyone who's on that level. I'm cutting you out. I'm impure, that's why I'm doing it. Forgive me. Yeah, then.
For the devotee families, what has security? Is adoption, if they cannot produce a child, should they adopt a child?
Should families who cannot produce a child, devotee families, should they adopt a child? What's that got to do with the point about Srila Prabhupada's purity?
He
brought people without any background of any purity, he made them devotees. If they don't have such purity, should they adopt children? I don't. How does that come? Who are they going to adopt? Someone from another from another Mletcher family, or what? Bring Indians, adopt children of Brahmana families, orphans. Well, orphans. Or what's the guarantee that they're going to be of good, from good background? No, by chanting the holy names, purification is there. See, there may be so many bad things in the heart, but by the commitment to chant Hare Krishna, that factor is so overwhelming that if we're actually committed to chant Hare Krishna, then despite all the bad things in the heart, one is considered a pure devotee in the sense that one's commitment is there to be a pure devotee. And it's only a matter of time before those bad things go away. So one who's chanting Hare Krishna with sincerity, even though they may have so many bad impressions in the heart, they're in a better position than someone who's maybe pure in heart in a previous age but doesn't have that faith in Krishna. And we see at the present time that there's still people of good Brahminical background, very pure families, but if they're not chanting Hare Krishna, they're not as spiritually advanced as people come from a very bad background and who are chanting Hare Krishna. They're not as dear to Krishna. In fact, one doesn't become dear to Krishna simply by being a Brahmana. With a non-Vaishnava Brahmana. And we see that children born of devotees, they're often very special souls. Still they need training. But they're very special souls. Prabhupada said that, it's another of those Prabhupada said, well known, which I don't have any reference for, but Prabhupada said that the demigods are queuing up to take birth in this movement. And that's stated in Shastra, in Srimad Bhagavatam, that the demigods, they want to take birth in Bharatvarsha and in Kali Yuga, because Kaling Sabhajyantyarya Gunagya Sarabhagina Yatra Sankirtananeva. What is that? Sarva Siddhim Labhyata. I can't remember exactly. In Kali Yuga, Kali Yuga is persons who are very intelligent, they glorify Kali Yuga. Because in Kali Yuga, simply by Sankirtan, all that is required, everything is perfect and complete. So in one sense, we shouldn't even be too worried about the impurities. We shouldn't think that, well, I'm so impure, I can't be purified. But we should have faith that, however fallen we are, we can be purified. But at the same time, we have to submit ourselves to the process of purification. If we think, well, I don't need purification, I'm okay as I am, then we can't be purified. So it's both perspectives should be there. On one hand, we shouldn't be so concerned that I'm very fallen, but on the other hand, we should have faith that everything will be attained by taking shelter of Krishna through the process of chanting Hare Krishna. Yeah, but on the other hand, we shouldn't think that, okay, I'm chanting Hare Krishna, so that's it. Don't have to bother trying to become purified. So, Hare Krishna. We'll finish there. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.